Hello and welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. Coming up today, why you should be looking up at the sky tonight. And this.
If it gets a bit like the Wild West, then the people who created these copyrights don't benefit.
Paul McCartney talking about the impact of artificial intelligence on musicians. We'll hear why more than 1,000 British musicians have released an album that mainly sounds like this. That's right, no music, just ambient studio sound. More on that later on in the programme. First, it is clear there is a lot of healing of transatlantic relations to be done after US peace talks with Russia that excluded Ukraine and Europe. The French and the US presidents were all wide smiles and clasping of each other's knees in Washington yesterday. After those talks, President Emmanuel Macron echoed President Donald Trump's ambition to reach a truce between Ukraine and Russia within weeks, and he said he was working with Britain on a proposal to send peacekeeping troops to Ukraine. We'll be asking what that might look like later on in the programme. But the story was very different at the United Nations in New York, where the US sided with Russia on a European motion condemning Moscow's aggression in Ukraine. And the UK and France abstained on a US-backed resolution. Barbara Woodward is the permanent representative of the UK to the United Nations.
What, how, and on what terms this war ends can only be decided by negotiations with Ukraine. No peace will be sustainable without Ukraine's consent. We regret that our proposals making these points clear were not taken on board, and as such, we could not support this resolution.
But those vastly differing stances will not stop the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer becoming the next European leader to head for Washington, D.C. He's due to meet President Trump there on Thursday. And today, Mr. Starmer made an announcement in Parliament that will certainly be welcomed by the White House, that UK defence spending would increase to 2.5% of gross domestic product by 2027. It's currently 2.3%.
We must change our national security posture, because a generational challenge requires a generational response. That will demand some extremely difficult and painful choices. And through those choices, as hard as they are, we must also seek unity, a whole society effort that will reach into the lives, the industries, and the homes of the British people.
I've been speaking to our political correspondent Rob Watson, who addressed the timing of the announcement ahead of the Prime Minister's visit to the White House.
Massively important, Paul, and not at all coincidental. I don't think there's any doubt that one of the main things that Keir Starmer was trying to do ahead of his visit to Washington on Thursday was to say to Donald Trump, hey, look, we in Britain and we in the rest of Europe, we get seriously your point that we Europeans need to be spending and doing more on defence. It was also interesting, I thought, Paul, that he resisted the temptation, as no doubt some would like for him to say, what are you doing, Mr. Trump, calling Zelensky a dictator and aligning with Putin. He was keen to sort of stress that Britain still wanted to have excellent relations with the United States. And what I take away from that is that it remains the desire of Britain and of other European countries, despite things like that vote that you referenced in the United Nations, despite Donald Trump's extraordinary overture to Putin, they're hoping upon hope that somehow that post-1945 transatlantic alliance can somehow be maintained, despite President Trump's occupancy of the White House.
Mr. Starmer described painful choices to pay for the increase in the defence budget. What did he mean?
He meant painful choices in the sense that Britain is going to be cutting its aid budget, which is not a popular decision within the governing Labour Party, in order to pay for it. So instead of raising taxes, borrowing more money, or cutting domestic spending, Keir Starmer has opted for that. And of course, there are many critics within the aid community, and indeed Mr. Starmer himself acknowledged that really in an ideal world you would not want to be cutting Britain's soft power, but I guess, you know, with Britain's economy stagnating, with its public services sort of feeling under massive stress, and with it not wanting to borrow or tax anymore, he would make the argument, look, we don't have much choice.
Will it have the support of the opposition?
It will. It does. I mean, there's one thing that that unites Britain's political parties. It's that Ukraine continues to need to be supported, and that in an ideal world, despite what people might see as the provocations of Donald Trump, to try and hang on to that post-1945 security structure, that is to carry on prioritising NATO and sort of hoping upon hope that visits like Macron's yesterday and Keir Starmer's later in the week, Paul, can sort of somehow, you know, turn the president around, or at least get him to sort of see the Europeans' point of view on Ukraine and cozying to Russia.
It's a tricky meeting coming up with Donald Trump, isn't it? What's the sense in Westminster of how Mr. Starmer should play it?
Well, I think the sense is that, tempting as it might be for, I don't know how many people who know that Love Actually movie where the British Prime Minister tells the American President off, I think the consensus is that that just wouldn't work, right? That no matter how disconcerted Keir Starmer and other Europeans might be about Mr. Trump's behaviour, that ain't going to work. So the way to play it is to, you know, is to say that Britain and others get that we need to do more for our security in Europe, and hope upon hope. I think what I get from officials is hope that actually President Trump hasn't yet made up his mind entirely about the transatlantic relationship, about Ukraine, about Russia, and that therefore visits like Keir Starmer's and Macron can make a difference. I mean, we'll see. I mean, it may be that President Trump doesn't regard the transatlantic relationship the way others do, and that it won't really matter much what, no matter how clever and diplomatic Keir Starmer are or Mr. Macron are, that it just won't make a difference.
That was our political correspondent, Rob Watson. Lord Kim Darroch is a former British ambassador to the United States and a former national security advisor. What was his reaction to Keir Starmer's announcement?
I've actually said a few times in recent interviews, I think, but I thought that Keir Starmer needed to take something on defence to his visit to Washington. So yes, I am. I think it's exactly the right moment. And I think he's gone as far as he probably can, or as far as the Treasury will allow him, in committing to reach 2.5% by 2027 and 3% in the course of the next parliament. So I think it's a good and necessary move.
To what extent?
Not just because of the meeting with Donald Trump, but because of the security situation that we face globally.
Well, I was going to ask, to what extent is it performative to curry favour in Washington? I mean, how much of the money will make its way straight away to Ukraine and help with the fight against Russia?
Well, in terms of, is it performative? I mean, it's certainly the timing is good for the visit to Washington. But in terms of the substance, look, it's absolutely necessary because of what we face in terms of the threat from Russia, the instability around the world, the problems in the Middle East, the threat to international shipping, the challenge from China. So yes, it's absolutely necessary.
He said it was a tough choice to have to cut foreign aid spending, but that actually could be an olive branch to Donald Trump too. Look at what's happening to US aid. He'll approve.
Well, he might, but I think that there are quite a lot of people in the UK, including some in Keir Starmer's own party, who will be disappointed by it. But and it's, you know, it's a key element in British soft power, and it can be an element for avoiding conflict around the world. So in a perfect world, you certainly wouldn't be doing it. But when you have to make, you know, prioritise, as we do at the moment, defence spending has to be the priority.
The German Chancellor-elect, Friedrich Merz, has expressed concern that the US was losing interest in European security. It doesn't sound as if he'll be doing much thigh-clasping in Washington anytime soon. Is that something that Britain's also thinking about?
I'm sure that my former colleagues in the Foreign Office are thinking a lot about this, and thinking about how serious the consequences would be if you got a comprehensive US withdrawal from Europe. I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think the answer is largely in Europe's hands, which is, you know, we're going to go up to 2.7% by 2027, well before the next election, and 3% is the commitment for the next parliament. We're already quite a long way ahead of some major European companies which still aren't at the 2%, to which they've had, you know, a long political commitment. So Europe as a whole has to step up. It's not enough for us and France and Germany is certainly spending more on defence. It needs to be everyone. And not just in Europe, by the way. Canada doesn't spend nearly enough on defence either. But if we all do that, then I think there is quite a persuasive case, given America's strategic interests, that they should remain committed to Europe and to NATO.
All that positivity between President Macron and Donald Trump, which presumably Keir Starmer will be trying to echo when he goes there later this week, are they all just overlooking the fact that the UN has just voted on two resolutions on Ukraine, and on both the US went against its European allies and sided with Russia, North Korea, Iran?
I agree with you that is fairly extraordinary. And I certainly can't remember the like of it in my 40-odd years in the Foreign Service. But in a sense, it's a symptom of where we are now and the way that so far the Trump administration is addressing the war in Ukraine. And I think Macron did well in his visit in Washington. I noted him saying in the press conference that Ukraine must not be surrendered, and also saying that Europe would be prepared to commit, you know, some ground forces to a deterrence force if there could be a peace deal or just a ceasefire. I think Keir Starmer will be taking much the same line. The key is to get Donald Trump, one, to focus on the detail of the negotiations. The moment you have Ukraine saying, we want all our territory back and we want the right to decide our own future in terms of joining NATO, and Russia saying precisely the opposite, no territory to be returned and Ukraine can never join NATO. So there's a huge gulf between the two. It's actually going to be quite difficult to bridge.
And in the meantime, it's fine as a diplomatic tactic, is it, briefly, just to say, ignore most of what he says. It doesn't matter that it's not true.
President Trump has always, in my experience of watching him, he reconstructs reality to suit the point that he is trying to make. And if you argued with every single sentence that he has said that is, in our eyes, detached from reality, then you would spend the whole meeting arguing about these points of detail and not the big picture.
Kim Darroch there, a former British ambassador to the United States. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Coming up, we hear from a man who's broken a world record for a marathon completed on crutches, and it could have been faster.
I had no idea that there was that the world record for a marathon on crutches existed. I didn't know it was a thing. So I didn't want to exaggerate what I'd done. But if I'd known then that there was a world record to break, I would have stopped having selfies with people along the way.
The headlines. The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has brought forward a planned increase in defence spending to be funded in part by cuts to overseas aid. South Korea's suspended president Yoon Suk-yeol has apologised to the people over his declaration of martial law in the final hearing of his impeachment trial. And Syria's interim leader Ahmed al-Sharaa has opened a national dialogue on the country's future, but Kurdish groups say they are being excluded. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Astronomers say tonight and tomorrow we'll see something rare known as the Great Planetary Alignment. That means that those looking at clear skies pretty much anywhere on the globe should get the chance to see all seven of the other planets in the solar system in a line. So how rare is this? Catherine Haymans is the Astronomer Royal for Scotland and a Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Edinburgh.
It is very exciting. We have had, for about the last 2 months or so, we've been able to see six of the planets up in our night sky. And this week, Mercury is joining the pack, which makes a full house. You know, you learn the order of the planets when you're at school, don't you? Mercury, Venus, Earth, which we're sitting on, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. And it's just so lovely that they are all up in the night sky at a reasonable hour. You don't have to stay up stupid late or wake up really early in the morning. They are all there to enjoy.
What do you need to see them apart from no clouds?
No clouds is definitely a good start. So Venus, that's your first one to spot because it's super easy. I always say if you see something in the sky that's as bright as an aeroplane, but it's not moving, that's probably Venus. So it's super bright in the western sky. If you head out about half an hour after sunset, the very first star you see in the sky is not a star, it's Venus. So that's where to start. And then Jupiter is kind of right above your head around that time, just about half an hour after sunset. And if you draw an imaginary line between Venus and Jupiter, kind of arcing across the sky, and follow it down to the east, then you'll meet up with Mars, the red planet over in the east. So those are the three that you can see with your eye. Really easy to find, particularly if you go out sort of about half an hour after sunset, because you can't really see the stars then. So those are the only things you can really see in the sky.
To see the little planets, the farther away planets, you need a telescope, presumably.
Exactly, yeah. So these are the harder ones to spot. So Uranus is on that line, we call it the ecliptic, between Jupiter and Venus, but you need a telescope for that. And Neptune is down below Venus. Now, we've got two other ones, Mercury and Saturn. So Saturn you can normally see with your eye, and we've been able to see it for the last few months, but it's getting very close to the sun now, so it's really hard to see it within the glare of the sunset. But that's not going to stop me from trying. I was out last night. You need a really clear view of the western horizon. I'd got myself all set up, and then the clouds rolled in, Paul, as always. But I'm going to try again tonight because I do love a good planetary parade. But those two, Mercury and Saturn, are really low on the western horizon. So if you can get to a place where you can see the western horizon really clearly, about half an hour after sunset, take some binoculars with you, because it's going to be hard to spot these two just because the sky is so bright. Download an app on your phone if you've got a smartphone. There are a wonderful array of apps. One's called Stellarium, it's free, but there are loads of other ones. And you can use that to point up at the sky, and it will tell you what you're looking at. So even if you can't see it, you at least know that it's there.
And how do you tell a planet from a star, finally?
So the planets that you can see, Venus, Jupiter and Mars, they're super bright. And they're Venus is brighter than all of the other stars. And they all follow this line, which just maps out the plane of our solar system.
It's all about the alignment. I think I get it.
Yeah. So when we say a great alignment, they're not aligned up in the solar system. They're just following this nice line across an arc across our night sky.
Catherine Haymans, Astronomer Royal for Scotland and Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Edinburgh. To the French capital now. Paris has been undergoing a transformation as it tries to ditch cars in favour of bikes and become a greener, less polluted city. Cycling rates have resultingly soared, but as the BBC's Anna Holligan reports, the recent death of a 27-year-old cyclist called Paul Varry revealed a dark side of Paris's cycling revolution.
Paul was leaving work one evening. He was going down the bike lane here.
Corentin Prudhoe shows me the place where in October last year Paul Varry was killed. Corentin knew Paul because they'd both volunteered on campaigns to make cycling safer in Paris. What happened to Paul made headlines.
Paul was on the bike lane. A car took that shortcut on the bike lane, ran over his foot. Paul, of course, got angry. He slapped the front of the car. The car backed up and then ran over him and killed him.
The driver ran over Paul's foot. He banged on the bonnet. The driver backed up and then ran over Paul.
Yeah, this was not an accident.
The driver has been charged with murder. He says it was an accident. Paul's death in a bike lane resonated with many here.
We all thought it could have been us. Cyclists suffer every day from violence on the road.
In the last few years, Paris has witnessed a cycling revolution. It's put in more than 1,000 kilometres of bike lanes. The number of cyclists has soared. More than 11% of trips in Paris are made by bicycle, compared to just 4% by car. But bike lanes come in all shapes and sizes, and it's not always clear who has the right of way. Arguments are frequent. Corentin took me out cycling.
So here we can keep going because it's green. Yes. It's a green bike, but this car is about to turn as well.
Yeah.
this is It's super confusing. I'm just going to go ahead of you to let the delivery driver. It's just chaos.
Well, I mean, nobody follows the rules, like the cars, the pedestrians, the bikes, nobody does. So at times it can be, yeah.
Yeah, driving in Paris is like going to the war.
Going to war?
Yeah. You have to be the main character, you know. There is no rules.
Shami is a 24-year-old midwife who still drives in Paris, but it's hard. Parking spots have been slashed by half. There's a low emission zone. Speed limits have been reduced. Streets have been closed to cars. It can be stressful.
Car drivers stop when there is a red light, but some bikes, they ignore it.
What do you do when there's a cyclist who's annoyed at you because you're in a bike lane and they hit the bonnet?
I say sorry and I try to move, but sometimes it's not possible.
You can see where we're sitting, waiting at these lights. There are cyclists going all the directions.
It's okay.
If you want mobility to be more agreeable in Paris, then the car drivers cannot be the only bad guys.
Alexandra Legendre, who works for a motorist lobby group, feels as though the authorities have bent over backwards to accommodate cyclists at the expense of everyone else, and not just drivers.
This aggressivity that you feel in the streets of Paris did not exist before that. Now, as a pedestrian, you're not safe anymore because you have scooters, you have bicycles, and they don't give a damn about road safety.
The Paris authorities acknowledge the need to improve cycling infrastructure and make sure everyone follows the rules. Rémi Ferraud is a socialist member of the French Senate.
La vision, non, ça n'est pas d'éradiquer la voiture.
The vision, no, it's not to eradicate the car, because there are Parisians who have cars. But by reducing the space for them, we reserve it for those who really need to use their cars. We want a city that is 100% cyclable. That means that bikes can pass safely and comfortably on every street.
Back on the streets, Corentin believes Paris will stick with its new direction of travel.
Cycling in Paris is freedom. It's not perfect, but it's a lot safer than it was before. There are so many bikes in Paris that I do think there's no way back.
That report's from Paris from Anna Holligan, and you can hear her full documentary. It's called Road Wars, Cycling in Paris. It's on assignment here on the World Service today. And don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but miss the live broadcast, there's an online version available, updated twice a day. It's BBC NewsHour podcast. That's what you need to look for. You can subscribe to the feed if you want to get it on a regular basis. Welcome back to NewsHour. It took Chris Terrell 6 hours, 11 minutes and 11 seconds to complete the Brighton Marathon on the south coast of England last year. He did so on crutches after a sporting injury. It's taken him a further 10 months to have his time confirmed as a new world record. Prompted by a friend, he discovered that not only was there a record for doing a marathon on crutches, but that he'd beaten it by 13 minutes. With the help of the marathon organisers, he's now had his achievement confirmed. Chris is no stranger to taking on a challenge. In 2007, as a documentary maker, he participated in the rigorous 8 months of training with the Royal Marine Commandos and then followed the newly qualified recruits to the front line in Afghanistan. My colleague Julian Warwicker asked him if, given his injury, he considered not taking part in that marathon.
Not really. I'd injured myself the summer before, playing cricket of all things. A lifetime of rugby, boxing, judo, but it's cricket that got me in the end. I leapt for a high ball, came crashing down and smashed my hip on a tree root. And I'd struggled on for a while, but it got too painful. So the surgeon said, no, Chris, let's get you a new hip. So that happened in November. I'd already entered the Brighton Marathon, which I'd done many times before. So as the time got closer and I was still on crutches, I thought, well, let's have a go. I'll amble around.
And you were raising money for an important
cause. I was raising, I'm an ambassador to the Royal Navy, Royal Marine Charity, which is very close to my heart. And I thought, well, I'll go through the process. I'll amble around in a gentle sort of way. But then, you know, the race started.
Yes.
And the competitive,
and yes.
Yeah, the competitive spirit and the what the Royal Marines taught me, and the determination and push on.
So you did the time, 6 hours, 11 minutes, 11 seconds.
Yeah.
And then somebody said to you, well, hang on a minute, you know, maybe that's actually better than you think?
Well, yeah, I had no idea that there was that the world record for a marathon on crutches existed. I didn't know it was a thing. So, you know, as I say, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate what I'd done, but if I'd known then that there was a world record to break, I would have stopped having selfies with people along the way.
So you eventually found out it was a record,
yeah,
and then it was about getting that sort of ratified.
Yeah, and Guinness World Records, you know, they were very amenable enough, but they said, no, we can't ratify it because we weren't there. There was no witness. So I said, oh, fair enough, just thought I'd try. But then Brighton Marathon organisers, who've been fantastic, I have to say, stepped in and said, well, hold on, Chris, there's nothing Guinness Book of Records or World Records could have done that we haven't done. We electronically measured your timing, you know, every 5 kilometres on the split. So we submitted their electronic timing to Guinness World Records with a letter from my surgeon, who wasn't, by the way, best pleased with me. anyway, so last week, Guinness World Records sent me a letter saying, we're thrilled to tell you that you're your new world record holder.
British world record holder Chris Terrell speaking there to Julian Warwicker. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. My name is Paul Henley. Now, the French President Emmanuel Macron says a truce between Ukraine and Russia could be agreed to in the coming weeks. He was speaking on Fox News Channel's special report with Brett Baier after his visit to the White House designed to keep Donald Trump on side. Mr. Macron repeated that European leaders were willing to be part of security guarantees for Ukraine.
We worked very hard together with the UK Prime Minister to have a French-UK proposal to say we are ready to send troops, not to go to the front line, not to go in confrontation, but to be in some locations being defined by the treaty as a presence to maintain this peace and our collective credibility with the US backup and the US backstop.
During Mr. Macron's visit, President Trump was asked whether he believed President Putin would allow European peacekeepers inside Ukraine as part of a deal.
Yeah, he will accept that. Asked him that question.
You talked to him?
Asked him that question. Look, if we do this deal, he's not looking for more war. He doesn't mind. But I've specifically asked him that question. He has no problem with it.
But things aren't quite that clear. When asked about it today, a Kremlin spokesman referred to a previous statement in which the possible presence of European peacekeepers in Ukraine was described as unacceptable. Much is still unclear about the peacekeepers that President Macron referred to. What might be the terms of their engagement? When might they be stationed there? And what might be the response of Vladimir Putin if the plan did go ahead? Well, I've been speaking to Camille Grand, who was NATO's deputy head for 6 years until 2022. He is now with the think tank, the European Council on Foreign Relations.
It only makes sense with a proper ceasefire and a proper peace agreement that makes that mission achievable and meaningful. That's the bottom line of the current conversation, which is to make sure that such security guarantees, which is the presence of European boots on the ground, I hesitate to call them peacekeepers because that implies a UN flavor to it, which is not what we're talking about here. It's more of a reassurance mission for the Ukrainians. And that could make a big difference, but the conditions have to be met, and we're not quite there yet.
France and Britain say they are prepared to send troops in certain circumstances. Vladimir Putin says he won't have them. President Trump says Vladimir Putin will have them. What do you make of it?
Well, we are still in the sort of negotiation phase. It is clear that France, Britain, and hopefully a few others are willing to show the European flag and demonstrate that when we say that what's happening to Ukraine is of vital importance for us, we mean it. On the other hand, it makes no point to go in a mission which is in unprepared ground with a bad deal that makes that presence very, very fragile. One example I would stress is that it only makes sense if the Ukrainian military continues to exist. That force is not meant to replace the Ukrainian army. It's meant to support it in a way and by sending that reassurance signal to the Ukrainian armed forces. So a demilitarized Ukraine would not need such a force. because it would be highly vulnerable in the first place, and we are not meant with 30 or 40,000 soldiers to do the job of 900,000 Ukrainian soldiers.
No, but deploying troops potentially in disputed territory is very high risk, wouldn't you say?
It is, obviously not an easy mission, but I think it makes sense if it's properly done. What I mean by this is that it has to come with a message to Ukraine that it makes it feasible for them to sign a ceasefire, and to Russia, which is do not try to resume the fighting. And this is a sort of test of your good faith in this arrangement. It also implies that the command and control arrangements, including those involving potentially NATO and the role of the US as a sort of backstop, are clear up front, even if there are no US troops on the ground.
Perhaps the number one problem would be that any arrangement would hinge on Vladimir Putin's word. Remember, he said he wasn't planning to invade Ukraine in the first place.
Indeed, and that's precisely the reason why I do not recommend to negotiate the terms of this arrangement with Vladimir Putin. Of course, Russia will have to be informed. But this is, it wouldn't make any sense to put that setup under a Russian veto of saying what type of weapons can be deployed, what's the size of the force. This is an arrangement between Europe and Ukraine that we inform Russia about and that we share the details with the US. But it is not something where we sort of take Vladimir Putin's word that he will behave. The reality is we have to assume that we might test the force, and that's why the force has to be robust enough and properly organized, benefiting from air support, air defenses, to make clear that testing the force would be a terrible idea.
How do you rate President Macron's powers of persuasion over President Trump?
Well, it's a difficult rating, because obviously I think he did well in turning the table a little bit on what are the priorities. But what was striking in their press conference is they were slightly talking past each other. President Macron was stating that there was a deal on the force, that the force would benefit from U.S. assurances, and that we were moving forward. Trump was not that clear. So I think it's a tricky thing, because when foreign leaders, and the prime minister will soon do this again in the next couple of days, visit Donald Trump, they need to strike the right balance between a flattery of saying, you know, we are here to support, because being confrontational doesn't really help, but also a form of strength, which is to say, Mr. President, there are certain things that we will not stand by, and therefore we really need you to be, we as Europeans are very clear on what we are offering, but there are certain things we will not sign up to, which is exactly what happened in the United Nations yesterday.
Speaking to me shortly before we came on air today, that was the former NATO Assistant Secretary General, Camille Grand. Now, what we're about to play you live on air is not a mistake. It's part of a new album released today. So it wasn't music, as you might have gathered. It was one of the tracks from the album, Ambient Studio Sound, representing what could happen to original music if artificial intelligence were offered a free rein. More than 1,000 British musicians, including Annie Lennox, Damon Albarn and Kate Bush, have come together to release Is This What You Want? It's an album protesting against the UK government's proposed changes to copyright law, which would allow tech firms to use copyrighted material to train generative AI models without controls and without payment. Sir Paul McCartney has been explaining to the BBC why he felt musicians like him would miss out.
Just worried about the copyrights not being protected, because if it gets a bit like the Wild West, then the people who created these copyrights don't benefit. And I think that takes away a lot of incentive, you know, because when we were kids in Liverpool, we found a job that we loved, but it also paid the bills.
Well, to get an idea of what this protest is about, I've been speaking to Ed Newton-Rex. He's a British composer and former AI executive himself. He launched the whole campaign, and I asked him why he chose this form of protest.
It's recordings of empty studios and empty performance spaces. So you can hear people sometimes walking around, you can hear papers ruffling. And the point of this is it's meant to show, you know, what we expect will be the likely outcome if the government's proposals for upending copyright law to favour AI companies come to pass.
What does the government want to do? How would you describe it?
Well, the government wants to change copyright law. It's currently illegal to train commercial generative AI models on copyrighted work, people's life's work, without permission, without a license, without paying for it. And the government wants to reverse that and allow AI companies to train on any copyrighted work that hasn't explicitly been opted out by a rights holder. So it basically turns copyright on its head, will inevitably end up with huge numbers of people totally missing the chance to opt out, because that regularly happens when you run these opt-out schemes. It will essentially facilitate the mass transfer of value from the creative industries and creators to AI companies.
Now, the government wants Britain to show the way in AI, and it says the current regime for copyright and AI is stopping our creative industries realising their full potential. What do you make of that?
I think the government should listen to creators and creative industries. I think if they could find any creators who would back them up on that, perhaps they'd have a bit more of a leg to stand on.
It's a mighty thing, artificial intelligence, and it has a mighty future. Isn't there a certain inevitability about this?
I mean, I think AI is fantastic in many ways. I'm certainly personally not anti-AI in any way. I think what's not inevitable is legalizing what's essentially the mass theft of IP to allow people to build these models. There are other ways of building AI. You don't need to take the life's work of the countries and ultimately the world's creators to build this. So I don't think that's inevitable.
It's a final day of consultation. What do you hope will come out of it?
I mean, ultimately, I hope that the government rethink their plan. Their proposal, I think, is totally unworkable, has been rejected outright by the creative industries, and ultimately totally lacks the nuance that we need in this kind of legislation. So what I really hope is that they reverse course and they get people round the table again. They bring the AI companies and the creative industries into the room together, and then they start talking.
How do you see in the future AI and human artists flourishing together, maybe even collaborating?
I mean, I think there's a lot of potential for humans to use AI in the creative process. People are doing that in many instances already. I've done that myself on numerous occasions. Ultimately, the simple way that this can be a symbiotic relationship is if AI companies pay for the works that they use in their products. And again, I mean, AI companies spend, you know, millions of dollars on software engineers. They spend billions of dollars on chips to train their models on. I see no reason that they should get the third key resource that they use, which is people's work, people's life's work, for free. So the sustainable way to do that is just to pay for it.
The artists that you're collaborating with in this protest are much admired. They have huge weight in the industry. They're also extremely rich already. Does that weaken their case in some people's eyes, do you think?
I mean, I don't think so, because, you know, there are more than 1,000 musicians on this album. Now, some are very famous, but many of them, the vast majority of them, are not household names. You know, these are people who don't have it easy at all. You know, the life of most creators in the UK is not an easy one. You know, salaries are not huge by any means. People are struggling, and AI companies stealing their work to compete with them is only making things harder.
That was Ed Newton-Rex, organiser of The Silent Record, a recording of people milling around in studios, made by some of the biggest names in British music to protest against the advance of AI. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We're live from London. We're NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour live from the BBC. Since the overthrow of the Assad dynasty in Syria at the end of last year, the country has been relatively peaceful. An attempt to establish lasting unity is underway now in Damascus, with Syria's interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, opening a national conference aimed at widening representation. In his opening address, he pledged to set up transitional justice committees to pursue those responsible for crimes against the Syrian people. He also said the conference was crucial to bring Syrians back together.
Syria liberated itself on its own, and it suits it to build itself on its own. This is an exceptional, historic, and rare opportunity. We must take advantage of every moment to serve the interests of our people and our country and honor the sacrifices of its people.
But parties in Syria's autonomous Kurdish region have complained that minority groups like theirs have only token representation there. Sarah Dadouche, who's a Syrian national herself, is the Financial Times' correspondent for the country and is covering the event in Damascus. How important, I asked her, was it?
I think the importance of this event will depend on what comes out of it and the decisions that come out of it, to what extent they will be applied. There are a lot of discussions happening in the national dialogue. There's a lot of opinions that are being put forth. There's a lot of suggestions that are being put forth. However much those suggestions and discussions and ideas are going to be incorporated into the formation of the new Syria, that's where the importance lies.
What kind of media access to it is there?
The media access has been limited, but more generous, I think, than a lot of us expected. The members of the media don't necessarily believe that it's because they're trying to restrict access to media. The problem with accessing the dialogue or the limited access is a result of, you know, the hastiness through via which this dialogue was organized. So we're not just talking media, we're talking invitees received invitations 2 days ago. A lot of them are in the States, they're in the UK, they're in Europe. They weren't able to get visas, to get plane tickets. So the fact that this dialogue was planned very quickly and very hastily has limited media's access to it, but it has also limited general access to it by contributors and participants also.
Why is it all so hasty? Why invitations the day before?
It's very unclear as to why, you know, the planning of the dialogue happened this quickly. This is something that they've been discussing for a long time. We knew it was happening. There's a sense that they probably wanted to get it out of the way before Ramadan, the Islamic holy month of fasting, begins, which is at the end of this month in a few days. But this has been a plan that's been put in motion for a while, and people are, you know, left pretty confused as to why this happened so quickly. I think none of the people who are here anticipated that it would be one day and that it would be announced 2 days earlier. And that it would just, you know, that there would be no clear agenda given as to how the discussions are going to play a role into the future of Syria.
Because the previous Ba'athist regime held an event with the same title months after the uprising against it began in 2011. It was boycotted by much of the opposition, but the proceedings were televised. How does this event compare?
So some of the proceedings are being televised. The sessions, the discussion sessions, follow Chatham House rules. Those have been repeatedly brought up throughout the sessions. The facilitators are actually doing a fantastic job, considering, I think, the, you know, relatively chaotic nature of the country and the fact that you're combining around 1,000 people in one place to discuss the future of a country that's been completely eviscerated on every level. So participation has been pretty strong, and there's been many dissenting voices from the beginning, from the first speech given in the first session. People have stood up and protested the lack of transparency when it came to deciding who is going to be invited, protesting the fact that this happened so quickly. And they've given room to those kinds of protestations, which I think people have been, they've been telling us they're pleasantly surprised by, and kind of bodes for hopefully good things to come.
How genuinely representative of diverse Syria is this conference? The Kurds hold about a third of Syrian territory in the northeast. They say they haven't been invited. The Alawite minority, where are they?
There are some Kurdish and Alawites, but many have decided to boycott, especially Alawites. We're hearing from some people that, you know, Alawites from Latakia, which is Assad's biggest stronghold, refuse to attend the conference. And there isn't really a consensus yet of exactly how many people are in attendance and what groups they belong to and what minorities they belong to. So it's a bit shrouded in mystery. But we do know that there are, you know, some people declined their invitations and refused to come.
Sarah Dadouche, Syria reporter for the Financial Times, speaking to us from the presidential palace in Damascus. Finally on the programme, Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent who tried to save President John F. Kennedy during his assassination, has died at the age of 93. Mr. Hill famously leapt into the back of the president's limousine after Mr. Kennedy was shot in Dallas, Texas in 1963, trying to shield him from further volleys. But the president had already been mortally wounded. Speaking to the BBC in 2013, Clint Hill described the moment.
I was on the running board of the car immediately behind the presidential vehicle. I was on the left-hand side. And all of a sudden, I heard an explosive noise over my right shoulder from the rear. Seemed to be from an elevated position. I then started to look toward that noise, but my vision only got as far as the back of the presidential vehicle. And I saw what happened in the car. I saw the president grab at his throat, and he violently moved to his left. And I knew something was wrong, so I jumped from my position and I ran toward the presidential vehicle with the intent of getting up on top of the rear of it to form a shield. But when the third shot was fired that hit the president in the right rear of the head, and there was blood and brain matter and bone fragments that came out of the wound, that material went all throughout the car, covered Mrs. Kennedy, the back of the car, and on myself as well. And when that happened, I was just about to get on the car. And then the driver accelerated. As I tried to get up, I had slipped because of the acceleration. I had to take a couple extra steps. I finally got up on the back of the car. And as I did so, Mrs. Kennedy came up in the trunk. She was trying to reach some material that came off the president's head. I got a hold of her and I put her in the back seat. And when I did that, the president fell to his left into her lap because his eyes appeared fixed and there was a severe wound in the upper right rear of his head. I assume that it was a fatal wound.
You can hear more of Clint Hill's account of that day by searching for the BBC programme The Reunion, The Kennedy Assassination. Thanks very much for listening to this edition of NewsHour for a Tuesday afternoon UK time. Goodbye for now.